Okay, a couple of things. I'm going to start about in 2 minutes, but I wanted to tell you 2 things. First, if you are not on the sign-in sheet, it means that you did not register by yesterday. If you have registered since yesterday, print your name at the bottom of the sign-in sheet and check that you are here. If you have not yet registered, please do register. If you are registered, find your name on the sign-in sheet and check that you are here. Secondly, for those people who have come in the last 5 minutes, Annie, whom you know, one of our students, has written a lovely and profound book of poetry called That Which Arises. You can take a look at it. There's a copy there on the table, and if you would like to support her and be inspired and intellectually stimulated at the same time, you might want to buy a copy also. So this is Annie, and her book is there. You can see her now or after class. I'll give people 2 minutes, okay? Because I think we've probably got to have a couple people straggling in. But not much more than 2 minutes. Announcement before we begin. Donna, would you make that announcement now?
For years and years and years.
Turn around and talk, turn around and talk them loud.
For years and years and years, everybody in the class has something to contribute, a 1 or 2 page little short anecdote about their life or a summary of their life. And they are one collection is in the red binder there. So feel free to borrow for a week, return it. They're really fascinating stories. They're also available on the website. But if you would like to contribute, think about doing a page or two about your life and give me a copy, and then we'll get it on the website. But it's an interesting collection from some people here and gone who have, you know, contributed stories about their life. It's worthwhile.
So if you would like to add to it, a synopsis of your life, a story about your life, a poem about your life, anything you want to put in there so your voice is heard, give it to Donna and she'll put it in the book, which you can look at and you can borrow week to week. Okay?
So it's a and I get it to Robert so he does it at
the. And also Robert puts it on swt.org/Spencer. So you're immortal. Okay, next. Next announcement. Leonard.
Good morning. Tomorrow I will be teaching a class at the White Center that is life-changing. It's called 110 Ways to Put a Real Estate Transaction Together if Only One is Cash. And Robin, one of my students, did you enjoy it?
I did.
Good. I've been doing it for 30 years and trying to get fired, but it doesn't work. So I'll be doing it again Saturday, 9 to 1 at the Wake Center.
At the Wake Center. Yeah. So 101 ways to put a...
Yeah.
110 ways. Oh, strong. Okay. 110 ways to put a real estate deal together where only one of them is cash. Okay. That's Len Jarrett. You might want to, if you're thinking about a real estate deal, he's the guy to talk to. Okay, is everybody about settled? Let's see, folks, come on in. Yeah. If you haven't signed in, please remember to do so on your way out on the sign-in sheet. If your name isn't on the sign-in sheet, it means you weren't registered as of yesterday. Please print your name on the bottom, check that you're here, and get registered. Okay. Because it's been on my mind for a whole week, before we even get started, I want to say about last week. If my explanation of the theory of everything psychologically wasn't entirely coherent, it's because I was sick and my brain wasn't working and I couldn't find the words. I will go over it briefly today. It's not majorly what we're going to do, but I will kind of review it today succinctly and more clearly. And secondly, that exercise we did, I should know better. That was overwhelming and confusing. There was just too much. What I should have done is, after I presented the theory, said, take one of the four basic needs and let's ask you the four questions about the closure that's involved and how to open it. Not all four of them. That was like trying to solve everything in one swell foop, and it pooped. If you missed last week, it was a very wise week not to be here for. All right, so here we go. Thank you. Actually, I did get a heck of a lot out of it. But I thought...
Take the vote. How many people...
Nah. All right, anyhow. That was then, this is now. We're talking about mindfulness. Okay, what we're going to do right now is we're going to do 10 minutes of mindfulness, or around 10 minutes. What I'm going to do is, I haven't taken the training wheels off yet, my voice is going to guide us through 5 minutes or so, and then I'll give you a few minutes to kind of practice on your own. Typically what happens is when a voice, mine or somebody's, guides you, it's very easy to be mindful. And then the minute there's no audio, you go lost in thought, and then you go, oh my God, where the heck was I? So I'm going to kind of set you up, but then you're going to have to keep coming back to your breathing every time you get lost in thought. And that's called, Trungpa called it spiritual manual labor. And when Jack Kornfield was asked, how many times do you have to do that before your mind stays, you know, where you put it? And he said, I don't know, 1 million, 10 million, 100 million. All right, so here we go. All right, so first, sit upright but not rigidly, so you're comfortable yet upright, in a dignified posture. Put both feet on the floor, so you're balanced and solid. If there's some article of your clothing that is preventing you from breathing freely, see if you can loosen it. If your shoes are pinching your feet, now that you're more aware, you will be preoccupied by that. So take them off or loosen them. And just let yourself come into the present moment. Really, the present moment is all we have. The past is an idea, the future is a projection. So what's happening at present? You are breathing. That's one thing that's happening at present. And you can feel that you are breathing. You will notice upon close inspection that your breathing actually involves your entire body. The most prominent aspects of your breathing are the rising and falling of the front of your body. the opening and closing, rising and falling, of your abdomen and chest. And you just notice that. Don't try to change it. Don't judge it and say, I've got to make it different. It is as it is. And you just rest your awareness on that movement. That keeps you present. If you get lost in thought, you will forget about your breathing, and that will mean that you are not fully present because you're not aware of your breathing. So see if you can stay aware of your breathing even as you become aware of other things. And when you lose your breathing, bring your attention back to it. Now, if you're really aware of your breathing, you become aware that your whole body is implicated in your breathing. That is, when you breathe in, your entire body opens and rises slightly. Your head and neck rise slightly. Your arms and shoulders turn out slightly. Even your legs and feet turn out with the in-breath, just slightly. And with the out-breath, there's a falling and a closing, just slightly. Head and shoulders come down. Hands and feet turn in. Front of the body sinks slightly or contracts slightly. So you just notice that opening and closing, rising and falling, that happens naturally at this moment. Whatever else you notice is perfectly fine to include in your awareness. Just remain centrally aware of the breathing as other things occur. Let your body calm down. You can't make that happen, but you can invite it to happen. And you do that by simply resting awareness on the breathing. The breathing is rhythmic, it's soothing, and it allows a peacefulness to come into your mind-body system. Let's now go through the body and especially release any tension that we're holding. While we do this, you can either remain aware of your breathing or you can return attention to it frequently. Sometimes when you pay attention to something else, you'll lose your breathing. That's okay. And then just come back to it when you remember or my voice suggests to be re-aware of it. So let's start with the breathing. Again, this is very easy to do. There's no effort at all. The breathing is there, you just notice it. Pay special attention now to your face and your head. If you're holding an expression on your face, as we do as we walk around, let that expression soften. Let it melt away. So the tension leaves the muscles of your face and the lines in your face smooth out. Your eyes are not held closed tightly, they're just gently, softly closed. Or if you're sitting with your eyes open, they're softly open. If there's any tension in your mouth and your jaw, let that tension release itself. So your mouth and your jaw are soft. Your mouth may be closed, it may even come slightly open. Similarly, the sides of your head, the back of your head, and the top of your head soften. Any tension is released. It's almost as though your face and head are disappearing. And where there was a formerly solid face and head, now there's a spaciousness, an openness. Just simply open awareness. And you can feel your breathing. You feel the rising and falling of the front of your body as you breathe. You just let the tension release itself from your face and your head and the rest of your body. Pay special attention to your neck and shoulders, arms and hands. If there's any tension in your neck and shoulders, arms or hands, you can let your posture shift slightly to release that tension. You can feel the release and the relief as the tension leaves the neck and shoulders, the arms and the hands. It's almost as though your neck and shoulders, arms and hands are disappearing. They're becoming so soft and open. It's almost as though they're not even there. If there's any tension that won't release itself, you just let it be there and create space around it. And in its time, it will release. And you can feel the rising and falling, the expanding and contracting, the movement of your body as you breathe, especially your abdomen and your chest rise and fall, open and close with your gentle breathing. Pay special attention to your thorax now, to your torso, to the middle of your body. If there's any tension in your back, the sides of your body, front of your body, or in your internal organs, let that tension release itself. It's almost as though your back, sides of your body, front of your body, and your internal organs are disappearing. It's almost like they're not even there anymore, and there's just spaciousness, freedom, and ease where there used to be a solid middle of your body. And you can feel the rising and falling of your breathing. Whatever else you notice is just there. You just include it. Pay special attention to your lower body now. Lower back, pelvis, legs and feet. If there's any tension in your lower back, pelvis, legs and feet, let that tension release itself, so that there's a freedom, a spaciousness, a softness, an openness that replaces the tension. It's as though your lower body is disappearing. It's almost like it isn't even there anymore. And there's just soft, open awareness where there used to be a solid lower body. And you can feel your gentle breathing just happening easily and naturally. It's almost as though your body isn't there. It's more like there's breathing and open awareness. And in that open awareness, various things rise and fall. Various things occur and then pass away. Sounds happen. Thoughts happen. Feelings happen. And you let them happen. You simply breathe and notice whatever is happening right at this moment. You don't get absorbed by it. You don't try to get away from it. You just breathe and include it in your awareness. So you're a breathing, spacious, aware being. Just note what's happening and stay aware of your breathing and open your awareness. If you're thinking, listen to your thoughts. If there are emotions, feel them. If there are sensations within your body, notice them. If there are sensations coming through your ears or other sense organs, notice them. Your job is just to open your awareness and notice whatever is occurring without getting caught up in any of it. If you're lost in thought and have forgotten about your breathing, come back to your breathing and what's happening right now. given moment, there are only two possibilities. You can either be actually present with what is occurring at that moment, or you can be lost in an abstraction, a thought about your life, what's occurring at that moment. In other words, you can be here, or you can be in some kind of idea of what here is. And the amazing thing is that people walk around for their entire lives never here, except very momentarily. A sound happens, and for a moment, they hear the sound, and they're into a thought about the sound. You know, the siren, thought about the siren. And we walk around almost all the time in this mental construction that we take to be ourselves in life. And it turns out that mental construction is a mental construction. It's not ourselves or life. In an 80-year life, there are about 600 million 3-second present moments. You probably heard, some of you have heard Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize winning economist / psychologist from Princeton, say that. 600 million 3-second present moments. It is possible to miss them all. Mindfulness is simply when you're walking around with your head in the clouds, at least find the ground and put your feet on it, and occasionally actually come out of the clouds. So that's what that's all about. I will talk about that week by week by week. When Joseph Bobrow comes in 2 weeks, I'm sure he'll have something to say about that. It's what he teaches. Okay, so here's what's going to happen next. There will be, as time goes on in this class, you know, we'll talk about mindfulness and the implications of it and the subtleties of it as time goes on. This is kind of just basic mindfulness. You've heard me say this too many times. So next week, Rabbi Eliyahu Gewirtz comes to class, and the following, he has agreed to at least attempt to answer all the big questions. So I'm going to sit him over here, and I'm going to say, Rabbi, why is there evil in the world? Little ones like that, you know. Why do kids die, you know? You see what he says about that. And then I'll throw the floor open to you so you can ask some non-trivial questions. So he's a brave man to have agreed to do that, but he's also a profound man. And so it'll be, I think, a quite extraordinary experience. And then in 2 weeks, Roshi Joseph Bobrow comes. And Joseph Bobrow is, if you Google it, I mean, he's a first-rank Zen master. He's somebody that teaches with the people, all the people that you've heard about. And he just happens to have moved to Santa Barbara, and I just happened to collar him. And he's going to come, and he's going to sit in the front of the room, and I'm going to say, Joseph, I'm going to interview him. And I'm going to say, you know, Zen, isn't that, you know, is there an afterlife in Zen? What happens when we die? You know, stuff like that. And see what he says about that, and then you're going to interview him. So that's what's happening in the next 2 weeks. Mind and Supermind. Roger Yanka is extremely well-known Qigong master who lives in Santa Barbara and teaches all over the world. And we got him to come to Mind and Supermind on February 29th. I think that would be worthwhile. Time to come to Mind Supermind.
Well, meditation on Saturday.
Oh, I'll talk to you about that in a couple of weeks. My Adventures in Consciousness class is Saturday, the 20th of February. But let's move on, okay? All right, I want to talk a little bit. Here's what I want to do right now. I want to talk a little bit about the theory that I sort of spun out to you last week. And then I want to show you two videos. One on the frontiers of neuroscience and one on the frontiers of theoretical physics. And you won't get lost by either of them, believe it or not. Just by me. Okay, so here we go. Here's what I said last week about one way to look at who we are and why we do what we do. What I said is we're like leaves on a tree. Each of us has an individual integrity. And we mostly consider that I'm my leaf. But if you know a little bit more about biology, where's the life? It's not in each leaf, it's in the tree, right? And if you look from a little further, it's not the tree, it's the forest. And if you look a little further, it's not the forest, it's the ecosystem. If you look a little further, you know, you can keep going. So the point is, at this level, we seem to be separate. But at a more profound level, we realize our basic identity. And what I said is, the universe did an extraordinary thing, at least on the Earth, a couple of billion years ago, which is organic molecules, which were still material, somehow got together and formed proto-RNA, which lives. So life arose some mysterious way that we don't understand yet from non-life. And when life arose in the universe, or at least in this corner of the universe, then the game changed, because the rocks don't care if they're rocks or sand. There's no motive to arrange as rocks. And in fact, the universe, by entropy, kind of runs down, right? It just kind of gets more disorganized. But life gets more and more organized and cares to stay organized. So there came this motive into the universe, at least the living part of it, to stay alive. And that's our basic motive, is survival. And because life hasn't figured out how to keep its individual units alive, a tree only lasts a certain amount of time, life also invented procreation. That is, if I can't stay alive, I'm going to pass my life along to the next generation so life can continue. So at the basis of everything that we think, feel, and do is the motivation to be alive and stay alive. In human beings, that motivation gives rise to four basic needs. And these are, for those of you who don't know the chakra system, these are the first four chakras. What are those four basic needs that serve the continuance of life? First, health and safety, as we need to be physically okay and not threatened, okay, first chakra. We need pleasure. Now, pleasure is a startling one. Again, Maslow didn't talk about that in the hierarchy of needs that you probably studied in school. Why pleasure? Because in nature, that which is pleasurable is that which supports life. You go toward and you consume that which is pleasurable. You go away from, you avoid that which is displeasurable because that would hurt life. So in nature, pleasure is a necessary way that things are motivated to get that which would increase their life. Human beings have screwed this up slightly, like we've kind of screwed up a lot of things, because we have invented pleasures that don't exist in nature, that don't serve your life, like cocaine, you know, for example. You know, it's pleasurable when people do it, but it hurts their life, it doesn't help their life. So we've invented chocolate eclairs, which are incredibly pleasurable when you do them, but they're not real good for you, you know. So human beings have to use their cerebral cortex to kind of ride herd on pleasure. But in nature, pleasure is a good indicator of things that take pleasure are things that are increasing their life. So pleasure is an important motive. And if you don't have any pleasure in your life, you're probably not thriving. Well, you're certainly not thriving. That's second chakra. Third of these basic needs is the self needs, the needs for identity, autonomy, and ability. That is, you need to know who you are so that you can identify what your needs are. You need to be able to make the choices in life so that you can get your needs met. And you need to have the ability to get your needs met. So this is what I call the strong self needs. They reside in the belly and the solar plexus in the chakra system. And then the fourth of these four basic needs is connection. We don't live alone. People who are well connected thrive. People who are isolated do not, mentally and physically. So we need each other in order for life to continue in each and all of us. So those are the four basic needs. And for each need, if you're getting that need fully met, you're vital. Your life is at its best level. If your life is not at its best level, one or more of these needs is not getting satisfied fully. And the question is, why not? And always, behind a need that isn't getting fully satisfied, there's some kind of, last week I called it a closure. It could also be looked at as a contraction, which is a word I forgot to tell you last week. So a closure, a contraction, a narrowing, a densification, a tensioning, anything that goes like this. That's a good thing to do for self-protection in the short term, but if you stay contracted, if you stay closed, if you stay tense, it will hurt you mentally and physically. So behind any need that isn't getting met fully, there's some contraction or closure or constriction happening. And then the question is, how do you open such chronic closures? And there are two strategies. Strategy one is you change your view of something. Strategy two is you change the thing itself. So if you live in an apartment where there's a lot of noise and you have to kind of put earplugs in your ears all the time, you have to kind of close yourself off from that, there are two possibilities. One is you can change how you look at that so it's not noxious. Well, that's just my neighbors having a good time at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you know, if you have no choice, if you're in jail or in prison camp or somewhere, you change your view because you can't change your circumstances. And people are very successful at that sometimes. But we tend to ignore the fact that sometimes it's the life circumstances that need changing, which is probably they need to go or you need to go. So any chronic closure or contraction needs to be opened by changing the view or changing the life circumstances. So that's what I told you last week as the theory of everything, as to why we're in well-being or why we're not doing so well. And I invite you to extend that to your own life, to think about this. If you want to see that written out, go to drspencersherman.com, go to writings, and go to the article Getting Our Needs Met, which says that, what I just said for you. Okay, writings, Getting Our Needs Met. We will come back to this in the spring. This is not non-trivial. We'll have to kind of work with this some more. But I just kind of wanted to get you up to date in a lucid way about what I said in a not-so-lucid way last time. So is there any question right now before we move on? Okay, so Abraham.
What would you do if your needs are ripped off by somebody else?
If you what?
Your needs.
Are
ripped off by somebody else.
No, I don't understand that question. Your needs are always your needs. So say it in a different way. What somebody else is preventing you from...
A person in prison.
Oh, okay.
And he's innocent.
So a person who is innocent in prison, okay, is not getting... not getting pleasure, it's a real problem. Probably all those four things are not being satisfied. That person probably doesn't... I would do two things were I in that situation, innocent in prison. First, I would try to change the circumstance by getting in touch with everybody I could and saying, I'm innocent, and people do that. They're actually able to get themselves sprung from prison by compassionate lawyers outside who say, I will investigate this. So I would do two things. I would try to change the circumstances, but I would also change my view. I would say, okay, I'm in prison, it's a noxious situation, but my thoughts are free. This is what the... Remember when Bonnie and David Paul came to this class, the freedom to choose people? Some of you remember that. That was incredibly awesome. They go to these prisons, and they have people sitting in prison, some forever, and they have them look at the fact that they have freedom to choose how they look at their circumstances. They can't change their circumstances, but they can start to look at their circumstances. And they have amazing results, just amazing results. So if you're in prison and it's unfair, or if you're in a prison camp, or if you're in a concentration camp, some unfair place, and you can't change the situation, what's free is your point of view. That's what... Who is the guy that came out of prison camp and wrote...
Viktor Frankl.
Thank you. I keep forgetting names when I'm up here. Logotherapy. Viktor Frankl went went to concentration camp and evolved his idea of the freedom of your consciousness in concentration camp. Amazing guy, Viktor Frankl. Okay, so that's an answer to that question. I think I got to move on, okay? Because we're going to Neuroscienceville right now. Now, let me say something about this speaker and especially the next speaker that we're going to see on the internet, which is really good. There are some people who are so good at their field, at such a position of mastery of what they do, and at the same time, such good teachers, that they can take the most complicated stuff and they can explain it really simply to everybody. That's called real mastery of both material and teaching. I know that those people exist in physical reality because we have had a guy named Gary Horowitz come to class twice. He's a theoretical physicist at UCSB and amongst the world's greatest physicists. And one time he talked to us about string theory, and one time he talked to us about the history of 20th century physics, and nobody's eyes rolled. The guy explained it so clearly that everybody understood everything that he said. These folks are like that. Okay? And I will probably stop the video several times to just underline some of the things that they say that are really important. So, let's take a little trip into the forefront of the two hottest sciences, I think, the two hottest areas in science right now. Yeah, we need that. Sunday at the library at 2 p.m., who's going to lecture?
A UCSB physicist.
A UCSB physicist is going to lecture about?
Planetary, it's physics.
Oh, it may be about what I just read about. Yes. Okay.
Same time that Simon Kahn is speaking.
Say again?
Same time
that Kahn is speaking at UCSB.
The Khan Academy.
Oh, Khan is speaking about the Khan Academy.
It's the same time.
It's 2 p.m. at the library.
And I'll remember what it is that I should have remembered entirely about. I remember what it is. It's probably that there is some compelling evidence for the fact that there is actually a ninth planet in the solar system. Okay? And that it's not Pluto, which is my favorite, and they demoted it to a fourth planet. But there's apparently a much larger body, 10 times the size of Earth, way further out, that is perturbing the objects out beyond Pluto. And there's compelling evidence for that, though we haven't seen it. That's probably what we're going to talk about, because that's a real
hot. And it's free.
And free at the library at 2 p.m. So if you can bilocate, you go see Salman Khan and you can go find out about the new ninth planet. Okay, so here we hopefully go. So this woman, she's French. You can understand her, but she's going to say one word that you're not going to understand. Adult. Adult, like you. Adult.
Can we, as adults, group new nurses. There's still some confusion about that question, as this is a fairly new field of research. For example, I was talking to one of my colleagues, Robert, who is an oncologist, and he was telling me, Sandrine, this is puzzling. Some of my patients that have been told they are cured of their cancer still develop symptoms of depression. And I responded to him, well, from my point of view, that makes sense. The drug you give to your patient that stops the cancer cells multiplying also stops the newborn neurons being generated in their brain. And then Robert looked at me like I was crazy and said, but Sandrine, these are adult patients. Adults do not grow new nerve cells. And much to his surprise, I said, well, actually, we do.
Okay, so that's the big deal. Neurogenesis. We were taught when we were going to school that you have, when you're born, you have all your nerve cells, and then you gradually lose them, and that's end of story. And that's the end of the story until about 10 years ago. But it turns out that you grow new neurons, new brain cells. Not a huge number of them, but in significant places. Okay. So that's what this is going to be about. And it's going to be about how to grow new brain cells.
And this is a phenomenon that we call neurogenesis. So now, Robert is not a neuroscientist. And when he went to medical school, he was not taught what we know now, that the other brain can generate new nerve cells. So Robert, you know, being a good doctor he is, wanted to come to my lab to understand a little bit better the topic. And I took him for a tour of one of the most exciting parts of the brain when it comes to neurogenesis. And this is the hippocampus. So this is this gray structure in the center of the brain. And what we know since already very long is that this is important for learning and memory and mood and emotion. However, what we have learned more recently is that this is one of the unique structures of the adult brain where new neurons can be generated. And if we slide through the hippocampus and zoom in, what you actually see here in blue is a newborn neuron in an adult mouse brain. So when it comes to human brain, my colleague Jonas Friesen from the Karolinska Institute has estimated that we produce 700 new neurons per day in the hippocampus. So you might think this is not much according to the billions of neurons we have, but by the time we will turn 50, we will have all exchanged the neurons we were born with in that structure with other born neurons. So why are these new neurons important?
Okay, so that's interesting. Even at the rate of 700 new neurons a day, which is not very many, given that we have 86 billion neurons in the brain, turns out that by the time you're 50, you will have regenerated your hippocampus. That's kind of interesting. That means that no matter how traumatic your childhood was, there's some indication, you know, it's not a one-to-one correspondence, obviously, but it is interesting that the neurons that were there when you were traumatized are not going to be the neurons you're there that are there later in your life. It's actually, the trauma doesn't reside in the neurons, it resides in the connections between, but still.
And what are their functions? So first, we know that they're important for learning and memory. And in the lab, we have shown that if we block the ability of the adult brain to produce new neurons in the hippocampus, then we block certain memory abilities. And this is especially new and true for spatial recognition. So like how you navigate your way in the city. So we're still learning a lot, and they are not only important for memory capacity, but also for the quality of the memory. And they will have been helpful to add time about memory, and they will help differentiate very similar memory. like, how do you find your bike? But you park at the station every day in the same area, but in a slightly different position. And more interesting to my colleague Robert is the research we've been doing on neurogenesis and depression. So in animal model of depression, we have seen that they have a lower level of neurogenesis. And if we give antidepressants, then we increase the production of these newborn neurons, and we decrease the symptom of depression, establishing a clear link between neurogenesis and depression.
Okay, so that's really important. You know, there's some... The question is why the antidepressant medications work to the extent that they do. It's questionable to what extent that is, but in some people quite well, and some people moderately, and some people not at all.
Wait, what was the drug that she was talking about?
It's
not an antidepressant.
No, yeah, she just said. I'll back it up so you can see it, but let me explain it first. Which is, so the antidepressant medication, the question is why they work to the extent that they do work. And it's long been debated whether the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors whether it's actually the serotonin in the synapses that makes the difference in lifting depression. The norepinephrine in the synapses that lifts the depression. So there's long been debate about whether that's actually true. There's a lot of doubt about that. But what we do know is almost all the current antidepressant medications do something else that is clearly true. They increase neurogenesis. So it looks like the antidepressant medications work for a different reason than we thought they worked for. They work by increasing neurogenesis, not necessarily by changing serotonin or norepinephrine metabolism. She's going to say more about this. I'll back it up so you hear it again. But that's a really important finding. And it's an encouraging finding because it says that these pills are more than placebo, which as of a couple of years ago, many of us thought was mostly the case. So here we go. Let's go back and you can hear her talk about this a little bit more. This is important stuff, obviously. Come on, you
can do this. And more interesting to my colleague Robert is the research we've been doing on neurogenesis and depression. So in animal model of depression, we have seen that they have a lower level of neurogenesis. And if we give antidepressants, then we increase the production of these newborn neurons, and we decrease the symptom of depression, establishing a clear link between neurogenesis and depression. But moreover, if you just block neurogenesis, then you block the efficacy of the antidepressant. So by then, Robert had understood that very likely his patients were suffering of depression even after being cured of their cancer, because the cancer drug had stopped the newborn neuron to be generated. And it will take time to generate new neurons that reach a normal function. So collectively, now we think we have enough evidence to say that neurogenesis is a target of choice if we want to improve memory formation or mood, or even prevent the decline associated with aging or associated with stress. So the next question is, can we control neurogenesis? The answer is yes. And we are going to do now a little quiz. So I'm going to give you a set of behavior and activity, and you tell me if you think they will increase neurogenesis or if they will decrease neurogenesis. Are we ready?
Yes.
Okay, let's go. So what about learning? Increasing?
Yes.
So learning will increase the production of these new neurons. How about stress? Yes, stress will decrease the production of new neurons in the hippocampus. How about sleep deprivation? Indeed, it will decrease neurogenesis. How about sex?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yes, you're right. It will increase the production of new neurons. Either we want, it's all about balance here. We don't want to fall in a situation about too much sex leading to sleep deprivation. So how about getting older?
It
So neurogenesis rate will increase as we get older, but this is still occurring. And then finally, how about running? So I will let you judge that one by yourself. So this is one of the first studies that was carried out by one of my mentors, Rusty Gage from the Salk Institute, showing that the environment can have an impact on the production of new neurons. And here you see a section of the hippocampus of a mouse that had no running within its cage. And the little black dots you see are actually newborn neurons to be. And now you see a section of the hippocampus of a mouse that had a running within its cage. So you see the massive increase of the black dots representing the new neurons to be. So activity impacts on neurogenesis. But that's not all. What you eat will have an effect on the production of new neurons in the hippocampus. So here we have a sample of diet or nutrients that have been shown to have efficacy. And I'm just going to point a few out to you. So calories...
Okay, so she's got to go through them, but you might want to look. These are the ones that are highlighted are the ones that increase neurogenesis. Resveratrol, although I've read, unfortunately, before you go out and drink a lot of wine, that it's a whole lot of resveratrol that we're talking about. Actually, they give it in pills. Omega-3 fatty acids. Probably should be taking an omega-3 fatty acid supplement of some kind. I mean, that Dean Ornish talks about that as a heart disease preventative. It's pretty well established. Caloric restriction. She's going to talk about that, unfortunately. blueberries, folic acid, zinc, flavonoids, curcumin, you keep hearing about more and more. Ask Dave Cubes about that. He's really big on curcumin. Caffeine and intermittent fasting. Okay, so let's let her talk about it. She's the expert.
Friction of 20-30% will increase neurogenesis. Intermittent fasting, so spacing the time between your meals, will increase neurogenesis. Intake of flavonoid, which is contained in dark chocolate or blueberry, will increase neurogenesis. Omega-3 fatty acid present in fatty fish like salmon will increase the production of these neurons. Conversely, a diet rich in high saturated fat will have a negative impact on neurogenesis. Ethanol, intake of alcohol, will decrease neurogenesis. However, not everything is lost. Resveratrol, which is contained in red wine, has been shown to promote the survival of these new neurons. So next time you're at a dinner party, you might want to reach for this possibly neurogenesis neutral drink. And then finally, let me point out the last one.
Understand? Alcohol decreases neurogenesis, resveratrol increases neurogenesis, so it evens out.
Quirky one. So Japanese groups are fascinated about food textures. And they have shown that actually soft diet impairs neurogenesis as opposed to food that require mastication, chewing, or crunchy food. So all of these data, where we need to look at the cellular level, have been generated using animal models. But these diets have also been given to human participants. And what we could see is that the diet modulates memory and mood in the same direction as it modulates neurogenesis, such as calorie restriction will improve memory capacity, whereas high-fat diet will exacerbate symptoms of depression, as opposed to omega-3 fatty acid, which increase neurogenesis, and also help to decrease the symptom of depression. So we think that the effect of diet on mental health, on memory and mood, is actually mediated by the production of the new neuron in the hippocampus. And it's not only what you eat, but it's also the texture of the food, when you eat it, and how much of it you eat. On the outside, neuroscientists interested in neurogenesis, we need to understand better the function of these new neurons and how we can control their survival and their production. We also need to find a way how to protect the neurogenesis of Robert's patients. And on your side, I leave you in charge with your neurogenesis. Thank you.
fantastic research on me. Now, I told you you changed my life. I now eat a lot of blueberries. I'm really interested in the running thing, okay? Do I have to run, right? Or is it really just about aerobic exercise getting oxygen to the brain? Could it be any kind of vigorous exercise?
So for the moment, we don't really say it's just, you know, the running itself, but we think that anything that indeed will increase the production of moving the blood flow to the brain, you know, should be beneficial.
Right, so I don't have to get a running wheel in my office.
No, you don't.
Okay, that's wonderful. So big to me. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
So if you, whoops. If you want to see that again, it's about 30 down on the TED list. It's Sandrine Thuret. You can grow new brain cells. Here's how. Very beautiful talk and a very important talk, obviously.
Does she do her research here or in France?
Oh, she's in France. I would guess. I don't know where she's. Oh, I can find that out in an instant, actually.
It's okay.
There's probably a bio right here. Let's find out where her lab is. King's College London.
Oh, wow.
King's College London is where her lab is. Okay. So let's go back. All right, so that's the frontiers of neuroscience. Oh, the hippocampus. I want to say a little bit about that just to acquaint you with it a little more. In the middle of your brain, the limbic system, which controls motivation and emotion and has a lot to do with memory, there is a horseshoe. It's called the hippocampus. There are actually two lobes. The two halves of the horseshoe are separate lobes, but we call the whole thing the hippocampus. It's a horseshoe in the middle of the brain, and at the ends of the horseshoe, there are two little almonds, one on each end of the horseshoe. Those almonds are the amygdala. There are actually two amygdalae, one on each side, but we call it the amygdala. The amygdala is important for it sets the body into fight or flight. So this middle of the brain part, which all higher animals have, has to do with remembering what happened and then taking action on the basis of that memory, especially avoiding getting eaten. Let's move now to the Large Hadron Collider, shall we? And this is a fairly recent TED talk. So the question is, what is the structure of the universe? And here we go.
Years ago this month, a 36-year-old Albert Einstein stood up in front of the Prussian Academy of Sciences in Berlin to present a radical new theory of space, time, and gravity, the general theory of relativity. General relativity is unquestionably Einstein's masterpiece, a theory which reveals the workings of the universe at the grandest scales, capturing in one beautiful line of algebra everything from why apples fall from trees to the beginning of time and space. 1950 must have been an exciting year to be a physicist. Two new ideas were turning the subject on its head. One was Einstein's theory of relativity. The other was arguably even more revolutionary, quantum mechanics. A mind-meltingly strange, yet stunningly successful new way of understanding the microworld, the world of atoms and particles. Over the last century, these two ideas have utterly transformed our understanding of the universe. It's thanks to relativity and quantum mechanics that we've learned what the universe is made from, how it began, and how it continues to evolve. 100 years on, we now find ourselves at another turning point in physics, but what's at stake now is rather different. The next few years may tell us whether we'll be able to continue to increase our understanding of nature, or whether, maybe for the first time in the history of science, we could be facing questions that we cannot answer. Not because we don't have the brains or technology, but because the laws of physics themselves forbid it. This is the essential problem. The universe is far, far too interesting. Relativity and quantum mechanics appear to suggest that the universe should be a boring place. It should be dark, lethal, and lifeless. But when we look around us, we see we live in a universe full of interesting stuff, full of stars, planets, trees, squirrels. The question is, ultimately, why does all this interesting stuff exist? Why is there something rather than nothing? This contradiction is the most pressing problem in fundamental physics, and in the next few years, we may find out whether we'll ever be able to solve it. At the heart of this problem are two numbers, two extremely dangerous numbers. These are properties of the universe that we can measure, and they're extremely dangerous because if they were different, even by a tiny bit, then the universe as we know it would not exist. The first of these numbers is associated with a discovery that was made a few kilometers from this hall at CERN, home of this machine, the largest scientific device ever built by the human race, the Large Hadron Collider. The LHC whizzes subatomic particles around a 27-kilometer ring, getting them closer and closer to the speed of light before smashing them into each other inside gigantic particle detectors. On the 4th of July 2012, physicists at CERN announced to the world that they spotted a new fundamental particle being created at the violent collisions at the LHC, the Higgs boson. Now, if you followed the news at the time, you'll have seen a lot of physicists getting very excited indeed, and you'll be forgiven for thinking we get that way every time we discover a new particle. Well, that is kind of true, but the Higgs boson is particularly special. We all got so excited because finding the Higgs proves the existence of a cosmic energy field. Now, you may have trouble imagining an energy field, but we've all experienced one. If you've ever held a magnet close to a piece of metal and felt a force pulling across that gap, then you felt the effect of a field. And the Higgs field is a little bit like a magnetic field, except it has a constant value everywhere. It's all around us right now. We can't see it or touch it, but if it wasn't there, we would not exist. The Higgs field gives mass to the fundamental particles that we're made from. If it wasn't there, those particles would have no mass and no atoms could form and there would be no us. But there is something deeply mysterious about the Higgs field. Relativity and quantum mechanics tell us that it has two natural settings, a bit like a light switch. It should either be off so that it has a zero value everywhere in space, or it should be on so that it has an absolutely enormous value. In both of these scenarios, atoms could not exist, and therefore all the other interesting stuff that we see around us in the universe would not exist. In reality, the Higgs field is just slightly on. Not zero, but 10,000 trillion times weaker than its fully on value. A bit like a light switch that's got stuck just before the off position. And this value is crucial. If it were a tiny bit different, then there would be no physical structure in the universe. So this is the first of our dangerous numbers, the strength of the Higgs field. Theorists have spent decades trying to understand why it has this very peculiarly fine-tuned number, and they've come up with a number of possible explanations. They have sexy-sounding names like supersymmetry or large extra dimensions. I'm not going to go into the details of these ideas right now, but the key point is this. If any of them explain this weirdly fine-tuned value of the Higgs field, then we should see new particles being created at the LHC along with the Higgs boson. So far, though, we've not seen any sign of them. But there's actually an even worse example of this kind of fine-tuning of a dangerous number, and this time it comes...
So I want to talk a little bit about this Higgs boson and the Higgs field, just the tiniest little bit. You've all heard about this. So they call the Higgs boson the God particle, right? Because it creates, it brings into physical reality stuff, gives things mass. And it's everywhere. The Higgs field suffuses the universe, right? It's basic in the universe. And so it because it has the value it has, the physical universe comes into being. It's kind of interesting from a spiritual point of view.
Wait. What? The God particle was actually a joke. It was the goddamn particle because they were having a lot of that.
Yeah, I understand, but
hold on. And it is not true that it causes So the particle is actually not important. The particle is just a way to reveal the field. The field does not bring things into existence. It just gives mass to things. And we probably don't have time for me to explain too much more, but it's not a fundamental, mass is not a fundamental property. It's kind of like, it's like resistance in electricity. You have something called Ohm's law in electricity, but it's a statistical property. Okay. It's a false property.
I understand what you're saying perfectly. I'm going to riff on it a slightly different way. It's probably going to offend you, but I don't think I'm wrong. Okay, which is the following. In theosophy, they talk about the universe having three aspects. The unmanifest, the manifest, and the movement between. Okay? The Higgs field seems to be that which brings the unmanifest into the manifest. That's typically, spiritually, what we call creation. I'm not going to go there, Robert. I'm going to say what I'm going to say, and after we finish this, then you can object to it, okay? I want to continue, okay? The other interesting thing from a kind of spiritual point of view about this is we all learn that the vacuum, the space is the absence of anything. It ain't there, right? There's nothing there. That's what space is. The universe basically is emptiness. But now we keep hearing about this Higgs field, which is this somethingness, this energy, this tremendous energy, which is in this nothingness. So what that brought to my mind was the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma in Buddhism. These are three basic understandings that have come into Buddhist thought. First understanding is mindfulness, essentially. How you don't suffer, how you can be free from suffering by identifying yourself as the awareness rather than the things that you're aware of. Second, and when you are mindful, then the second question comes up is, who am I if I'm not my thoughts, my feelings, or my body? And so the second turning of the wheel of Dharma is the teaching of no self. The teaching of the fact that everything is in flux and impermanent, and there is no actual you. It's the teaching of nothingness, the basic fact of nothingness as underlying the somethingness that we see. That's the second turning of the wheel of Dharma. But that was unsatisfactory. People didn't want to think there's nothing. The basis of everything is nothing. So the third turning of the wheel of Dharma was the teaching of Buddha nature. Buddha nature is that which is there underneath the nothingness, the source level, if you will, that everything is at its most fundamental part of has Buddha nature. Even if when we look at it, it seems empty. So I look at this and I keep thinking about the zero point field or this Higgs field. You know, in the nothingness there is this somethingness. The basis of the universe isn't nothing, it's a something that then issues nothing, that then issues something. So I just want to throw this stuff out. Now, if Robert's cringing, physicists, if there were physicists in there here, they'd be throwing up. But I get to do this, okay? Because I'm trying to bridge science and spirituality in this class. Okay, so we're going to go back to the science in it.
Robert.
Yeah.
What's the difference between dark energy and the Higgs field?
Say this?
Dark energy.
Oh, that's very different. That's a different thing, yeah. Dark energy is something we don't accept. It's very different. Okay. All right, so back to this. What he just said so far is there's a weirdness in the universe, which is the Higgs field should either be off or it should be at a tremendously high level. It's actually at a very low level. But if it were at any other setting, then that extremely fine setting, the universe as we know it wouldn't exist. Okay? Which is kind of interesting. right, so here we go.
From the other end of the scale, from studying the universe at vast distances. One of the most important were the Higgs boson. So far, though, we've not seen any sign of them. But there's actually an even worse example of this kind of fine-tuning of a dangerous number, and this time it comes from the other end of the scale, from studying the universe at vast distances. One of the most important consequences of Einstein's general theory of relativity was the discovery that the universe began as a rapid expansion of space and time 13.8 billion years ago, the Big Bang. Now, according to early versions of the Big Bang theory, the universe has been expanding ever since, with gravity gradually putting the brakes on that expansion. But in 1998, astronomers made the stunning discovery that the expansion of the universe is actually speeding up. The universe is getting bigger and bigger, faster and faster, driven by a mysterious repulsive force called dark energy. Now, whenever you hear the word dark in physics, you should get very suspicious, because it probably means we don't know what we're talking about. We don't know what dark energy is, but the best idea is that it's the energy of empty space itself, the energy of the vacuum. Now, if you use good old quantum mechanics to work out how strong dark energy should be, you get an absolutely astonishing result. You find that dark energy should be 10 to the power of 120 times stronger than the value we observe from astronomy. That's one with 120 zeros after it. This is a number so mind-bogglingly huge that it's impossible to get your head around. We often use the word astronomical when we're talking about big numbers. Well, even that won't do here. This number is bigger than any number in astronomy. It's 1,000 trillion times bigger than the number of atoms in the entire universe. So that's a pretty bad prediction. In fact, it's been called the worst prediction in physics. And this is more than just a theoretical curiosity. If dark energy were anywhere near this strong, then the universe would have been torn apart, stars and galaxies could not form, and we would not be here. So this is the second of those dangerous numbers, the strength of dark energy, and explaining it requires...
Okay, so I have to retract something, which will make Robert feel a lot better. I confused this suffusing dark energy with the Higgs field. And so the Higgs field only is the creator, but dark energy is the source.
The Higgs field is the analogy to the Higgs field is imagine a famous person in a room full of people trying to cross the room, and people are gathering around them, impeding their movement. And that is like the inertia that we see when we try to accelerate an object due to its mass. So it's not in any way a fundamental property of the universe. It's just this added on thing. We think of mass as being the thing that makes something exist, and it's not. It's just this extra property.
It's this extra dimension.
And it's a dimension that's not even very fundamental.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so we parse that out. So back to dark energy. What I just said about the Higgs field mistakenly is what I should have said about dark energy, which is, why is there this energy in the vacuum? Why is there this stuff in nothing? So back to this now. And the problem with dark energy. Here's where the theory and the experimental result don't agree. Startlingly. Here, I'll let you hear it again. This is as complicated as it gets. It does get more complicated than this, folks. Here
we go. This is a number so mind-boggling what dark energy is, but the best idea is that it's the energy of empty space itself, the energy of the vacuum. Now, if you use good old quantum mechanics to work out how strong dark energy should be, you get an absolutely astonishing result. You find that dark energy should be 10 to the power of 120 times stronger than the value we observe from astronomy. That's one with 120 zeros after it. This is a number so mind-bogglingly huge that it's impossible to get your head around. We often use the word astronomical when we're talking about big numbers. Well, even that won't do here. This number is bigger than any number in astronomy. It's 1,000 trillion times bigger than the number of atoms in the entire universe. So that's a pretty bad prediction. In fact, it's been called the worst prediction in physics. And this is more than just a theoretical curiosity. If dark energy were anywhere near this strong, then the universe would have been torn apart. Stars and galaxies could not form, and we would not be here. So this is the second of those dangerous numbers, the strength of dark energy. And explaining it requires an even more fantastic level of fine-tuning than we saw for the Higgs field. But unlike the Higgs field, this number has no known explanation. The hope was that a complete combination of Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is the theory of the universe at grand scales, with quantum mechanics, the theory of the universe at small scales, might provide a solution. Einstein himself spent most of his later years on a futile search for a unified theory of physics, and physicists have kept at it ever since. One of the most promising candidates for a unified theory is string theory. The essential idea is, if you could zoom in on the fundamental particles that make up our world, you'd see actually that they're not particles at all, but tiny vibrating strings of energy, with each frequency of vibration corresponding to a different particle, a bit like musical notes on a guitar string. So it's a rather elegant, almost poetic way of looking at the world, but it has one catastrophic problem. It turns out that string theory isn't one theory at all, but a whole collection of theories. It's been estimated, in fact, that there are 10 to 500 different versions of string theory. Each one would describe a different universe with different laws of physics. Now, critics say this makes string theory unscientific. You can't disprove the theory. But others actually turned this on its head and said, well, maybe this apparent failure is string theory's greatest triumph. What if all of these 10 to 500 different possible universes actually exist out there somewhere in some grand multiverse? Suddenly, we can understand the weirdly fine-tuned values of these two dangerous numbers. In most of the multiverse, dark energy is so strong that the universe gets torn apart, or the Higgs field is so weak that no atoms can form. We live in one of the places in the multiverse where the two numbers are just right. We live in a Goldilocks universe. Now, this idea is extremely controversial, and it's easy to see why. If we follow this line of thinking, then we'll never be able to answer the question, why is there something rather than nothing? In most of the multiverse, there is nothing, and we live in one of the few places where the laws of physics allow there to be something. Even worse, we can't test the idea of a multiverse. We can't access these other universes, so there's no way of knowing whether they're there or not. So we're in an extremely frustrating position. That doesn't mean the multiverse doesn't exist. There are other planets, other stars, other galaxies, so why not other universes? The problem is, it's unlikely we'll ever know for sure. Now, the idea of the multiverse has been around for a while, but in the last few years, we've started to get the first solid hints that this line of reasoning may get borne out. Despite high hopes for the first run of the LHC, what we were looking for there, we were looking for new theories of physics, supersymmetry or large extra dimensions that could explain this weirdly fine-tuned value of the Higgs field. But despite high hopes, the LHC revealed a barren subatomic wilderness populated only by a lonely Higgs boson. My experiment published paper after paper where we glumly had to conclude that we saw no signs of new physics. The stakes now could not be higher. This summer, the LHC began its second phase of operation with an energy almost double what we achieved in the first run. What particle physicists are all desperately hoping for are signs of new particles, micro black holes, or maybe something totally unexpected emerging from the violent collisions at the Large Hadron Collider. If so, then we can continue this long journey that began 100 years ago with Albert Einstein towards an ever deeper understanding of the laws of nature. But if in 2 or 3 years' time, when the LHC switches off again for a second long shutdown, we found nothing but the Higgs boson, then we may be entering a new era in physics. An era where there are weird features of the universe that we cannot explain. An era where we have hints that we live in a multiverse that lies frustratingly forever beyond our reach. An era where we will never be able to answer the question, Why is there something rather than nothing? Thank you.
Hey, even if you just said the science may not have some answers, I would like to ask you a couple of questions. Yeah. And the first is, building something like LHC is a generational project. I just mentioned introducing you that we live in a short-term kind of world. How do you think so long-term, projecting yourself out a generation when building something like this?
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky that I joined the experiment I worked on at the LHC in 2008, just as we were switching on. And there are people in my research group who've been working on it for 3 decades, their entire careers on one machine. So I think the first conversations about the LHC were in 1976. And you kind of start planning a machine without the technology that you know you're going to need to be able to build it. So the computing power did not exist in the early 90s when design work began in earnest. One of the big detectors which record these collisions, they didn't think there was technology that could withstand the radiation that would be created at the LHC. So it was basically a lump of lead in the middle of this object with some detectors around the outside. But subsequently, we have developed technology. So you have to rely on people's ingenuity that they will solve the problems, but it may be a decade or more down the line.
Now, China just announced 2 or 3 weeks ago that they intend to build a supercollector twice the size of the LHC.
Yeah.
I was wondering how you and your colleagues welcome the news.
Well, size isn't everything, really. That's funny for a cosmologist to say that. But you know, seriously, it's great news. So building a machine like the LHC requires countries from all over the world to pool their resources. No one nation can afford to build a machine this size, well, apart from maybe China, because they can mobilize huge amounts of resources, manpower, and money to build machines like this. So it's only a good thing. What they're really planning to do is to build a machine that will study the Higgs boson in detail and could give us some clues to whether these new ideas, like supersymmetry, are really out there. So it's great use of physics, I think.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So I want to talk about that last thing, just the tiniest bit about China's plan to build a machine twice the size of the LHC. Two things. First, given the latest economic developments in China, that may or may not come to pass. Things are changing in China. But secondly, I think there's kind of a real tragedy here, and the science community in the United States certainly feels this, which is the future is going to depend more and more on our understanding, our science and technical understanding, you know, our understanding of the world and how to manage it. And one reason that the United States is in the place that it's in now is because there was a great deal of money and effort put into scientific and technical progress in this country, and it was a world leader in that respect. If we keep deprioritizing basic science in this country, which we're doing, and not moving money into it, moving money away from it, what will happen will be this country will fall to a second-rate position in terms of science and technology, and that would be really bad for our well-being and our economy. And this is a really huge problem. I think I told you this. When I went back a couple of years ago to my friend from college's lab, he's a Nobel Prize winner in molecular biology, I don't know if he's gotten any other Nobel Prize winners from his lab yet, but there are certainly several people right online for Nobel Prizes. So this is one of the best labs in molecular biology in the world. He has 26 graduate students. It's at MIT. It's an amazing lab. So we went there to visit, myself and a bunch of friends of his, and he was complaining about the fact that he almost shuttered his lab a couple of years previously because he couldn't find funding. This is a Nobel Prize, one of the most eminent scientists in his discipline in the world. Okay, he works on why we age, important stuff, and he couldn't find funding. And so I asked him, where in the world is funding available for basic research, scientific research like this? And not only
him, but the other guys there who are all, they're MIT guys, they all are involved in science and technology in some way or other. It's like they rehearsed it. They, together, I mean, it's like, where in the world, Bob, do you find funding for this? And they took a breath, and together they said, China, in unison, and then they took another breath, and India. And, you know, I'm happy for China and India for that, but I'm really, really, really dismayed about the idiocy of the decisions we're making about our future in terms of defunding thing after thing after thing that have to do with space exploration and theoretical physics and biology and all the stuff that we should be investigating. We got a break. I hope that if a guy that used to be in this class used to call this class the Great Friday Morning Headache. Because we reduced them like this. So I hope this wasn't too mind-boggling for you. I think that they both did an incredibly good job of talking about complicated stuff in a simple way. Next week, we'll talk about the basic spiritual nature of humor. Okay, have a great week.